Everybody, and welcome back to New Books in History. I'm Marshall Poe, your host. Each week we pick a history book that we find particularly interesting, and we interview the author of that book. This week we have Alex Rabinowitz on the show. It's a real treat for me to talk to him because he's somebody that was important in my own graduate experience, and I've used his books in my undergraduate teaching and graduate teaching as well. We'll be talking today with him about the Bolsheviks in power, the first year of Soviet rule in Petrograd. This is Alex's third book on the Bolsheviks. He wrote a book quite a while ago on the July days, and then he wrote a book on the actual seizure of power in October. And this book takes the story further into the first year of Soviet rule in Petrograd itself. So there's a lot of ground to cover, and I think we should get to it. Here's the interview. Hi, Alex.
Hi, Marshall.
How are you today?
I'm fine. We're just getting over the after effects of Ike. Yesterday, we wouldn't have been able to talk because we didn't have electricity for most of the day.
Is that right? All the way in Indiana. Is that true?
Yeah.
I did not know that. No, we didn't get
hardly... I lost the Colt game.
It was
dear to my heart.
Yeah, right. No, that's interesting. We didn't have any such thing here. We had floods earlier in the year, but no Ike this time. That will make it easier for historians to date this conversation since we just mentioned a hurricane. I should tell our listeners that today we're extraordinarily fortunate to have Alex Rabinowitz on the show, and we'll be talking about his new book, The Bolsheviks in Power. I can tell you that when I was in graduate school reading Alex's books was absolutely necessary, and now that I teach graduate school, I can tell you that it is equally necessary. We assign them to all of our graduate students here at Iowa who study Russian history, so we're really, really fortunate to have one of the founders of the field and somebody who is still very active in it and extraordinarily important. So I will really say to the listeners and say to Alex that it's all my pleasure to do this interview today. It's really quite a treat for me.
Thanks so much. I really appreciate it.
Oh, it's absolutely my pleasure. So if you would do us the favor of saying just a little bit about your own background, how you got where you went to school and how you got interested in Russian history and how you came to write your first books, we'd be very pleased.
Well, I'll try not to get bogged down because my earliest years had a lot to do with shaping my education and my career and my life. I was born in London, England. My dad was a native of St. Petersburg, Russia. He had immigrated, fled actually. During the period of the book, which we're going to talk about today, The Bolsheviks in Power, my mother was Russian. She had been an actress she was from Kiev, but Russian Jewish, and in Russian theater in Europe when she and my father met. In fact, I'm now looking on one side at my mom in a costume from a show probably in the early 30s in Europe.
Mm-hmm.
And on the other side, the cover of the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists, which my dad founded and edited.
Is that right?
For most of his life.
Is that right? Wow.
Yeah. And it says, In Memoriam, Eugene Rabinowitz, A Voice of Conscience,
uh-huh,
for the Atomic Age is stilled. Anyway, so that's the milieu in which I grew up in. I learned Russian before English.
Mm-hmm.
My twin brother and I, Victor is my twin brother. He is the former senior vice president of the MacArthur Foundation, now retired.
Right? Huh.
My father had been trained as a biochemist, a physicist. He had first fled in August 1918 to Poland, couldn't finish his PhD in Warsaw because of the havoc, managed to get to Berlin, studied with Einstein and Max Planck, von Laue, the sort of key figures in physics and biophysics at the time. And he was fortunate enough to to get a job at the University of London, so he was able to get out of Berlin before Hitler.
Mm-hmm.
And he was equally lucky and fortunate to get an offer from MIT while he was at the University of London.
Mm-hmm.
So he escaped the war, and we escaped the war, and
mm-hmm.
I grew up in Watertown, Massachusetts, outside Boston,
mm-hmm.
where my dad was at MIT, but always surrounded, and maybe we can talk about that later, but always surrounded by the cream of the Russian immigration in the U.S. East Coast. And I myself went to, my dad was on the Manhattan Project and went back to MIT.
Mm-hmm.
And then when I was in junior high school, he was on the Manhattan Project, or actually I was in grade school, in fifth and sixth grade.
Mm-hmm.
And we were at the University of Chicago,
mm-hmm.
then moved back to, my dad got an offer from the University of Illinois.
Mm-hmm.
And I went to high school in Champaign.
Mm-hmm.
And then I went to a small college. And I've been teaching at a large university all my life, but still very devoted to my college. And most people have never heard of it. But
and where was that?
Knowing that you graduated, I think, from Grinnell.
I did.
I graduated from Knox.
Oh, there you go. I think we played them in basketball many times, and they beat us every time. Yes, I know Knox very well.
I understood from somebody that you played basketball. Did you play for Grinnell?
Yeah, I did play for Grinnell, and I still played. I just retired. I'm about the same age as Michael Jordan, and I just retired last year. I just like to put my name in a sentence with Michael Jordan. That's really all right. I know Knox very well, yeah.
I played, but this was way before your time. Tennis against the Grinnell team for Knox.
Oh, is that right?
At one point.
Uh-huh.
I then went to the University of Chicago, where I had my I was interested in political science, but took a course in Russian history. I had been sort of drawn to Russian history and culture by the milieu in which I grew up.
Mm-hmm.
We just to back up a hair, we spent summers, the first with two couple of summers after we got here, at the summer home in southern Vermont of Mikhail Karpovich, who whose name you know well.
Yes, I do.
And among the regular guests were people like Nabokov, Vernadsky, Tomashev, Pedotov, Kerensky, Zinzinov. After we were there a couple of years, then my father bought a farm, which got 122 acres for $2,200, which he kept mortgaging for years and years and years, and which we still have and still love and spend a lot of time there.
That's
but
great.
Now we are the only Russians there.
Yeah.
Somehow the Karpovich a farm, which is no longer in the Karpovich hands, were more liberals. So were moderate socialists such as Kerensky and Vernadsky. Although my father was too young to be in politics, he always said he would have been a cadet. Russian Liberal Party, at our farm somehow people like Boris Nikolaevsky, the archivist of Social Democracy, mm-hmm. and the Menshevik, Irakli Tsaratelli, mm-hmm. one of the Menshevik ministers,
mm-hmm.
in Kerensky's government, people like that tended to be at our place, but we did mushroom together and sort of interact, and that's where I sort of developed my first love for Russian history and culture.
Yeah, I mean, that's a remarkable story. You should write your memoirs of that if you have a chance.
I've done it partly. Sheila Fitzpatrick has a memoir about how she became a revisionist in the current issue of the Slavic Review.
Mm-hmm.
There's sort of an addendum to that on the Slavic Review website, in which I talk about how I became a revisionist.
I haven't had a chance to read
and
that.
Bring some of that in. And I also, on the 280th anniversary of Pittsburgh University, a few years ago, St. Petersburg University published a three-volume book on famous graduates of St. Petersburg, from Herzen to Benoit, you name it. They seem to have gone to St. Petersburg University. Anyway, I was asked to do one of them on my dad, and I collected a lot of family archives and letters. And he's a poet and the specialist for many, many years in photosynthesis. And and I had all that material and photographs and whatever, and I finally got it together and wrote a long essay. And
that's terrific.
At least some of my memoirs are in there. And I figure I'm too young at 74 to
talk
about memoirs.
You can definitely wait a few years. Although I had a friend who wrote his memoirs at 22. Me too. But that's what he did. But I was just going to say, I mean, most of our listeners won't know this, but that world of Russian emigres is now largely gone. And it used to be very strong and dynamic. There were journals that were published entirely in Russian for these Russian emigres. They founded a lot of what were called the small magazines. And it used to be a very vibrant community. I know I heard a lot of this from my own dissertation advisor, Nikolai Valentin Sreznovsky. But now I think that it's gone now. I mean,
largely gone, and the kids, I count me among the kids, are all that's left, and I think a kind of a dull offspring compared with the liveliness of the great ones.
Well, certainly.
And Karpovich, for one, had founded the Novi Journal, which was one
right.
of the main
that's what I meant. Yeah, right.
journals, and was one of the founders of the Russian Review.
Mm-hmm.
So yes, that's and even in Vermont, I mean. We got the new Russian word, Novoruska Slova.
Novoruska Slova, yeah.
Every day. And that we were about, in both cases, we were about 2-3 miles from the local post office and with no car. And so the daily chore that many of the people would take part in was going down to the post office, getting over Novoruska Slova, dividing up the pages and reading them.
Right, yeah.
At Knox, there was nobody in Russian history, and I developed an interest in political science and history. And I went from Knox College to the University of Chicago, where I was in the International Relations Committee with thinking that I would somehow get into international things, and took my first course in Russian history from Leopold Hamson, who was then in Chicago. And while he never got to the revolution of the revolutionary period, he just really was so wonderful in inspiring students. And and he, of course, he's still alive. And still
yes,
producing.
He is. That's right. Yeah.
He was one of the main forces that attracted me to a professional interest in Russian history. Then I had to do a 2-year stint. At that time, everybody had a service obligation. I had been an ROTC at Knox, and had a 2-year obligation. I spent 2 years in the Army, then came back, finished my MA at the University of Chicago with Hamson, where I did a dissertation on Maxim Gorky's A Visit to America in 1906, which I've never published. And then I came to IU, Indiana University.
Uh-huh.
Indiana University was then a budding center of Russian studies, I did my PhD here, My main influence here was John M. Thompson, if you know that name.
Yes,
but,
I do.
He was a wonderful, wonderful teacher. He is still also producing. He does redoes his basic text in Russian history every 4 or 5 years, and he teaches. He lives in Maine and teaches at a branch, I think, of the University of Maine for seniors. But anyway, he instilled in me a love of research, which has stayed with me my whole life. And Robert Burns, one of the founders of Russian Studies in the United States, but very conservative. Jack Thompson, John, he had a much more nuanced view. At that time, Robert Tucker, the Stalin biographer, was also at Indiana University. I studied with him, and between the two of them, they really instilled a sort of a more detached view of the Soviet Union and Russia, detached enough to do serious research. And so I had been so taken by Tseretelli when he came to visit us in Vermont that I decided I was going to do it seems funny now. A biography of Tseretelli, easy enough. And the problem was I didn't know Georgian, and I got 3 or 4 months into it, realized that without Georgian, it was hopeless to do a serious biography of Iraklu Tseretelli, who was a Menshevik, but a very central figure in 1917 Russia. Phil Mosley, who had been a diplomat and was then teaching history at Columbia, we had lunch. He came to visit at Indiana. He had known Tseretelli. He said, "You know," he said, "why don't you look at Tseretelli in 1917, and particularly in July, because." He was really, really central to developments there, and so then, and so I sort of transferred my interest from a biography of Tseretelli to the Tseretelli and the Mensheviks in July 1917, and very quickly, even before I went on the exchange in 1963-64. To Russia, I saw, I was shaped by the circle I grew up in, and by ROTC, and by the Cold War, and by the McCarthy era, all of which I had lived through before then, to be anti everything to do with Russia and the revolution, but there was such. And here I credit Thompson with making me, sort of instilling me a loyalty to sources. Here I saw this incredible discrepancy, even in the sources that you could see then, which were somewhat limited. It was many, many years until I would get to see Russian archives. But even in the sources I could see, there was a huge discrepancy between the traditional view of the Bolsheviks in 1917, held by Tseretelli, that they were a small group of fanatics led by Lenin, financed by the Germans, et cetera, et cetera. And what was coming out of the sources, the memoirs, the newspapers of the time, they were available. And it was quite clear that the Bolshevik role was much more complex. The revolution was much more complex. There was a real question in my mind about German money. And so that's so I quickly switched from Tseretelli in the summer of 1917 to the complexities of the Bolsheviks in from February to July 1917. That's how I came to write my first book, Prelude to Revolution, the Petrograd Bolsheviks and the July Uprising. I graduated, I got my PhD at Indiana in 1965. You stop me if I'm talking.
No, you go ahead.
I taught at USC for a couple of years. Finished the book. It came out. This was in 1968, got an offer, which was very unusual at the time. At the time, universities normally did not hire their own. I think probably places like Harvard did,
mm-hmm.
but state universities like Indiana certainly did not.
Mm-hmm.
But I feel very fortunate that I was hired by Indiana,
mm-hmm.
and that was in 1968, and mm-hmm. I've been on the faculty of Indiana University ever since.
That's a great career. That's fantastic. Yeah, that's really great. Why don't we begin talking a little bit? Let's talk shop a little bit here, and let's go. Actually, I wouldn't mind going through the three books, because I should tell the listeners that there are actually three books on this period. The first one, which you've already mentioned, is Prayer to the Revolution, the Petrograd Bolsheviks in July 1917, and that's 1968. And then the second book is The Bolsheviks Come to Power, which is about the revolution in Petrograd, and that came out in 76. And then the third book is the one that we're actually talking about today, or we're going to talk the most about, which is The Bolsheviks in Power, the First Year of Soviet Rule in Petrograd, and that's just come out. But let's go back to the first book. What was the primary finding of Prelude to Revolution? Because it does have kind of a revisionist moment in it, if I recall.
Yeah, the biggest finding at the time, the standard interpretation of the events of June and July 1917 were that they were a failed attempt by the Bolsheviks to seize power.
Mm-hmm.
Studying the period 1917 to July, February 1917 to July 1917, it quickly became apparent that it was much more complex than that.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, very quickly after February, there was great disenchantment among workers and soldiers with the results of the revolution,
mm-hmm.
great frustration. I mean, perhaps that's endemic to revolution,
mm-hmm.
To satisfy the hopes and dreams that
mm-hmm.
are born during a revolution. And this came very quickly in Russia. My father remembered those February
mm-hmm.
days, marching down the streets in the euphoria that sort of captured everybody.
Mm-hmm.
But that didn't last long. And there was dissatisfaction, very growing dissatisfaction with the continuation of the war and Russia's participation in the war and the results of the revolution, particularly with regard to food. The February revolution had been caused in major ways by bread shortages, and those shortages continued, and they got worse. So that there was this ferment from below. The Bolsheviks were the only party that stood for immediate peace,
mm-hmm.
and a peace, land, and bread.
Mm-hmm.
And formed during the February Revolution were Soviets as kind of a counterweight to a popular counterweight, workers, soldiers, and peasants to the what was considered then the elitist provisional government by
mm-hmm.
workers.
Mm-hmm.
The Bolsheviks emerged as spokespeople for the downtrodden, and really were. Now, that's at one level. At another level, there were great differences among the Bolsheviks. They weren't the sort of united,
mm-hmm.
unique small group of revolutionary fanatics that they were generally presumed to be at the time. But it was clear to me that they had a left wing and a centrist and moderate Bolsheviks.
Yeah, if I could just jump in right there. I know that when I was in college, this view still had some currency, and I think it comes from reading too much Lenin. Honestly, I think that one of the things that Prelude to Revolution did, in my own experience, was to show us that the Bolsheviks were not a kind of I can't remember the Leninist term for it. I guess it's democratic centralism, but
Right.
it didn't really operate according to that principle at this point.
And it, you know, it is almost ridiculous in retrospect to think that it might. When you've got when it suddenly became a mass party.
Yeah.
And you've got all these different, very well educated leaders. And all these different pressures that different segments of the party were under, and that's the other element in the whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
The Bolshevik Petersburg Committee was under pressure from really, really impatient workers who were getting hungrier and hungrier and getting more and more disappointed, and workers that didn't want to go to the front to support an offensive that was pressed on Russia by the Allies to put some pressure on the Eastern Front.
Mm-hmm.
And so there was all this dissatisfaction. And what I found was that Lenin, as hard as it is to accept, was trying to keep the lid on.
Mm-hmm.
until his forces were organized enough and had broad enough support, particularly of the Russian peasantry, which where the Bolsheviks did not have much of a following
mm-hmm.
at that time. He was trying to keep the lid on. Meanwhile, as were moderate Bolsheviks who could continue to play a major role in revolutionary politics,
mm-hmm.
Bolshevik politics through October, actually through January 1918.
Mm-hmm.
We can talk about that later. In any case, under pressure from workers and garrison troops that didn't want to go to the front, the Bolshevik military organization and the Bolshevik Petersburg Committee organized the July uprising, which was really pressure to get the Soviet, the All-Russian Soviet, which was then dominated by moderate socialists, Mensheviks and SRs,
mm-hmm.
To take power.
Mm-hmm.
And Lenin, actually during the July days, and probably one of the at the start of the July days, and probably one of the best signs that he didn't have anything to do with it, is the fact that he was out on vacation
mm-hmm.
and didn't get back to Petrograd, which was the wartime name
mm-hmm.
of St. Petersburg, until the movement was well underway.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess, going back to your original question, what I think my book did was to, you know, I hope I'm not being sort of grabbing too much for myself, but I think it, in a lot of people, it established the principle that the Bolsheviks were not monolithic in
mm-hmm.
in 1917.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I think one of the things the book does is it sort of scotches the conspiratorial theory of the Russian Revolution, that is that there was a very small group of people who were doing absolutely whatever they could in order to gain power, including all kinds of subterfuge and things like this, because the Bolsheviks were largely, as you point out, acting in the open. The party was not united. There was an active effort to curry favor among factory workers and soldiers. They were forced to start practicing real politics. And
exactly. And there was unlike other parties, there was the Bolsheviks had very, very close links in the in the barracks and the factories,
mm-hmm.
and rank and file Bolsheviks had real influence on decision making, sometimes for the good and sometimes for the bad.
Mm-hmm.
But you can see it. So the party is, as opposed to this closed, secretive, monolithic party, it is virtually the opposite.
Mm-hmm.
It's transparent. It's
mm-hmm.
It's open. It's sort of interactive with the masses, and it's operated relatively democratically.
It's funny you mentioned reading newspapers, and one of the most revelatory things I ever discovered, and I believe this was in graduate school, was that the newspapers at the time, in the summer of 1917, were describing almost exactly what the Bolsheviks were doing. And they were publishing some of these things themselves. So this notion that this notion that we have of this very closed, secretive organization, can't be very closed and secretive if you can read what's going on in the newspapers. So it's kind
of sure, and you can buy on the streets. You can buy the newspaper of the Bolshevik military organization.
Yeah.
You could buy Pravda, the party paper.
Yeah.
And you could compare the two and see how they differ.
Yeah,
and
exactly,
that was the way I came to my conclusion.
Sure.
But it was just a marvelously fruitful topic
for
which
I'd
be eternally grateful to Mosley, and the response to the book, surprising to me, was really very positive.
Uh-huh.
The other thing you mentioned that Lenin, reading Lenin is one of the reasons why there was this view of the monolith.
Mm-hmm.
But it was also the émigrés.
Mm-hmm.
Because, here they had been sort of uprooted and forced out of their country, and it seemed to them that the only one way one could explain it
mm-hmm.
was by a military coup,
mm-hmm.
Probably financed by the Germans. I mean, they really, and over time, they mm-hmm. became more and more wedded to that idea.
Mm-hmm.
That was the idea I grew up on, but
mm-hmm.
that I was quickly disabused of as I looked at the newspapers. And in the 1920s, as opposed to the 30s and the 40s and the 50s, really interesting documents were published in the Soviet Union, and work in them
mm-hmm.
was very fruitful.
Mm-hmm.
So all in all, I had a wonderful experience, which sort of set me off on a path which is sort of really, really crazy. I mean, if you look at, just to skip ahead for a minute, if you look at my three books, the book on the July Uprising, which takes 3 months, the Bolsheviks Come to Power, which takes the revolution through October 1917, and then the first, the Bolsheviks in power, the first year of Soviet rule in Petrograd, I have spent my entire life, in 3 years of Russian history. And it is almost impossible for me to believe, but I have to tell you that it was so wonderful finding out all these things that undercut standard interpretations and raise new questions. Each book raised new questions.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I mean, the July book illustrated this very different party than
mm-hmm.
was traditionally thought of, but it also this chaos that ensued because of the differences in July then raised the question of how the Bolsheviks got it together for October.
Yeah, let's talk about that now. Let's go to the second book, The Bolsheviks Come to Power.
Sure. Well, for the Bolsheviks Come to Power was written in the late 60s and 70s, and I say that because that was at a time when archives were still closed, and
mm-hmm.
I was still left with the same sources I had been,
mm-hmm.
I had used for the book on the July Days Prelude to Revolution,
mm-hmm.
but I used the same paradigm of the divided party and studied the different groups and the revolution from below and the link between the two. And came out with the Bolsheviks Come to Power, which also was quite successful. Now, quite successful in very modest and unambitious terms, in the sense that I guess it was required reading at least for quite a long time. And editions keep coming out. There's a Turkish edition coming out
right?
in a few weeks,
wow.
and the Korean edition that came out 3 months ago.
That's great.
But anyway, I use the same methodology, and what had happened was that Lenin had been forced to flee Petrograd after the failure of the July uprising, mm-hmm. even though he wasn't responsible for it. And the party was largely in the hands of Bolshevik moderates, who play a much, much more important role in all of 1917 than they're generally credited with. I've just written an article for Isaritsky Zapisky on the role of the moderates in mm-hmm. 1917 and 1918.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, under their guidance, the Bolsheviks stood for peace, land, bread, free Soviet,
mm-hmm.
certainly not Soviet power, all power to the Constituent Assembly. Their program, after a downturn after the July uprising, actually I should mention, as you well know better than I, or certainly as well, there was an attempted failed right wing coup
mm-hmm.
by General Lava Kornilov,
mm-hmm.
Chief of Staff of the Russian Army, and when it failed, the Bolsheviks were the main benefactors, and they had a program which was very, very, very appealing. It was for a multi-party, exclusively socialist government
mm-hmm.
to govern until the convocation of the Constituent Assembly, which
mm-hmm.
would come. Quickly. One,
mm-hmm.
of, one of the problems in 1917 was that liberals were nervous about convening the Constituent Assembly during the war when things were in such chaos.
Mm-hmm.
So they had, I don't know if they had, in any case, it was delayed and delayed and delayed and postponed. And as a result, the Bolsheviks stood for immediate peace. They were the only party that stood for immediate peace. They stood for immediate convocation of the Constituent Assembly and all those things. So they had a great deal of popular support.
Mm-hmm.
Lenin, meanwhile, was in hiding. And what I think, if I just repeat the question that you asked
mm-hmm.
about the July uprising, what was the main thing that the Bolsheviks come to power showed was that it was a real revolution.
Mm-hmm.
That there was an element of a revolution from below, and sort of a revolution from above, or leadership from above,
mm-hmm.
By the Bolsheviks, and until the last minute by the moderate Bolsheviks. Lenin had it been the party that was described. In traditional descriptions, monolithic, responding to Lenin's every command, in mid-September, way, way before things were ready, he called for the immediate seizure of power.
Yeah.
And the party was so structured that it just ignored Lenin. It just ignored Lenin,
mm-hmm.
and that was one of the, I think, eye-openers,
mm-hmm.
if there were eye-openers, in the Bolsheviks come
mm-hmm.
to power. But also that what it was for and the dynamics of it.
Mm-hmm.
The moderate Bolsheviks, the left Mensheviks, the left SRs all worked towards transfer of power to Soviets
mm-hmm.
that... a Congress of Soviets, the Second Congress of Soviets
mm-hmm.
in October 1917. Lenin was very much opposed to that. His main concern was for the Russian Revolution to be a sort of signal for the start of the World Revolution.
Mm-hmm.
And there were, at that time, signs of revolutionary unrest in the German Navy. Actually, all over Europe, there were signs of unrest, partly growing out of the war and the dislocation growing out of the war. And so you can't understand October, and you can't understand post-October, and you can't understand Lenin's behavior unless you link it to his hope and that it would spark the world revolution and the European revolution, ultimately the world revolution, and that the world was certainly Eastern and Western Europe were ready for immediate revolution, and he expressed confidence that the Russian Revolution could not survive without support from the West, and so that was his assumption. The moderate Bolsheviks rejected the idea that Europe was ready and were anxious to build bridges and have a multi-socialist coalition government. At the last minute, after the stage had been set for the a transfer of power, the Second Congress of Soviets, Lenin came out of hiding and was able to get enough supporters, and the situation had become so unstable that there were some elements of a military seizure of power, so that image of sort of a popular revolution, Lenin's major role at the end, but secondary role, the dynamics, the role of individuals. I tried really, really hard, and I have in all my works, and admittedly with only modest success, to make each book stand by itself and to have each book readable to an undergraduate, at least undergraduate who knows a little bit about Russian history.
I think you've succeeded in that.
I hope so. It was hardest in my last book, and I'll explain why. But I really tried, the Bolsheviks Come to Power was an alternate history book club selection, and did quite well. It's recently been published and republished in the United States.
Yes,
and,
that's right.
As I say, many foreign editions.
That's fantastic.
And, it was the first book on the October Revolution, on the Russian Revolution, published in the Soviet Union under Gorbachev.
Is that right? Wow.
Yeah,
that's great.
And one of the funnest moments in my life, one of the most satisfying moments in my life, was that day in 1989, when in the Progress Publishing House in Moscow, my book was, we had the publishing company Progress that published the book, had a book launch. And,
that's fantastic.
To see so many people who had called me a bourgeois falsifier
for
my entire life, there and clapping.
Standing there, singing your praises.
And also kids of people who had participated.
Yeah.
They weren't kids anymore.
Yeah.
They were closer to my age.
Yeah.
But it was just a
It must be remarkable. Well, let's go on to the present book, The Bolsheviks in Power, the First Year of Soviet Rule in Petrograd. And just to set the scene then, the Bolsheviks have succeeded in taking power, but we should say in the name of the Soviets. And then,
and then
they find themselves in a position of having to govern until the Constituent Assembly meets and forms what will be, according to them, an all-socialist coalition government. That's not quite what happens, though. Maybe you could go on.
Right. Well, what happens is that this coup that Lenin engineers at the end, which I just mentioned, when everything was ready to for the transfer of power to the Second Congress. And unstable, he managed to get, he came out of hiding literally that day, October 24th, 1917, into the old calendar, and managed to get some of his followers who could see that, who shared his impatience, some of whom, not all, who shared his impatience for a media revolution. It could see that now the stage was set, and so and you can really by studying carefully, you can pinpoint the exact time when there's a change from a defensive strategy aimed at transferring power at the Second Congress of Soviets to seizing power before the Congress was convened. Literally a matter of hours when all this stuff takes place. And it happens under pressure from Lenin, and that had an enormous impact. For one thing, then the Second Congress of Soviets was faced with a fait accompli. The Bolsheviks have seized power. Bolsheviks, even before it is convened, in the name of the Petrograd Soviet, the city Soviet. Lenin says that power has been transferred, announces that power has been transferred. And so when the Second Congress of Soviets meets, the Mensheviks, with the sound of cannon literally shaking the windows, of Smolny, where the Congress was held, and with their colleagues under fire, their colleagues in the provisional government, the Mensheviks and the SRs walk out of the Second Congress of Soviets, leaving the Bolsheviks in the majority with the left SRs and some other socialist parties still in. Even the Menshevik Internationalists, led by Martov, walk out. And so that creates a situation, and the Bolsheviks tried at that moment to get the left SRs to join them in the government. The left SRs were convinced that a multi-party inclusive socialist government under the aegis of the Soviets was absolutely necessary for the survival of the revolution. They refused to participate. That meant that, and the Menshevik Internationalists had walked out. Within, incidentally, Nikolaevsky, one of the guests at every summer at our farm in Vermont, going out with Martov and. It is a wonderful memoir in Socialistический Vestnik, the Menshevik journal, about that moment. But anyway, that leaves just the Bolsheviks to form a government. They form an exclusively Bolshevik government, the Sovnarkom, which is supposed to be a temporary government. It is said so in the decree until the convocation of the Constituent Assembly.
And then the Constituent Assembly actually meets, but not for very long.
Well, there's maybe one additional thing I'd like to add. You've got the elections to the Constituent Assembly. They come on November 14th, about 2 weeks after the, or a little over 2 weeks after the Bolsheviks seized power. And they had been under preparation since August, and the voting list. Had been prepared in August, and so they didn't reflect, not that the result would necessarily have been any different, but they reflected the situation more in August than in October. And so the results of the Constituent Assembly, which are well known, and I think which are reliable, gave the SRs, the Socialist Revolutionaries, the Peasant Party, the led by Viktor Chernov, a majority in the country. But the key to the Bolsheviks sort of managing things is that the Bolsheviks won in Petrograd, and they won in the Petrograd garrison and mm-hmm. in the Northern Front, among soldiers in the Northern Front, on the Northern Front, outside Petrograd. The result of which is that even though the SRs have a majority, the Bolsheviks, and on the eve of the Constituent Assembly, the left SRs finally gave up and joined the Bolsheviks. With the Bolsheviks and the left SRs in the minority, the Bolsheviks and the left SRs still have control of the situation. They still have their majorities in the Soviet, mm-hmm. and they're able, without much trouble, to dissolve the Constituent Assembly,
mm-hmm.
Which ended for decades and decades,
mm-hmm.
Until the Gorbachev Treaty. Any hope of a democratic Western-style government in Russia, but it is terribly important to get in that the effects of the election on good fortune of the Bolsheviks from the Bolsheviks' point of view.
Mm-hmm. And how did the Bolsheviks excuse the closing of the Constituent Assembly after it was closed?
It's really pretty ludicrous. They said that the program that the SRs presented as the majority presented was very close to the Bolshevik moderate program and the Bolshevik program in 1917.
Mm-hmm.
But the Bolsheviks and the left SRs had prepared a sort of a platform, a thesis written by Lenin for the adoption by the Constituent Assembly. When the Constituent Assembly decided to vote on the SR planks rather than the Bolshevik left SR planks, the Bolshevik and left SRs walked out.
Mm-hmm.
They then announced in the Central Executive Committee, which was the leadership body of the Soviets, all Russian Soviets, that once they walked out, the remaining SRs, the Mensheviks, had very, very few delegates to the Constituent Assembly, and many of the cadet delegates had been arrested.
Mm-hmm.
So it's mostly SRs. They said literally this, that it was no longer representative mm-hmm. of anybody. It was a bunch of counter-revolutionaries, mm-hmm. and it passed. And a lot of memoirists have, I think, accurately explained the failure of the Constituent Assembly, if you get right down to it. The bulk of Russia, of the Russian people, were not the peasantry primarily were not versed in Western style government.
Mm-hmm.
They had gotten a lot of what they wanted from the Soviets, and they just didn't care.
Mm-hmm.
And what Zinoviev and a number of other leading delegates write in their memoirs is that what killed us was that the population was not ready to defend us. It really didn't care.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. I mean, you have some remarkable scenes in the book. I should tell the readers they're really wonderful scenes of the hall itself and the first and, I believe, last meeting of the Constituent Assembly, which is something between what you might see on C-SPAN, that is the American Congress, and a riot, as far as I can tell, because
probably a little worse in the sense that the only visitors they would allow in the upper balconies were soldiers and sailors that were armed, and
yes.
So they're cocking their guns,
yeah,
ready to shoot. It was a little, they were being a little soft there.
Yeah, no, I can only imagine.
Really, it was, and a number of the delegates were. Were fearful that they wouldn't be able to, of the SR delegates, that they wouldn't be able to return home alive. Lenin said, "Don't let him go home." It was clear to him that there wouldn't be any, for the moment at least, certainly there was.
Mm-hmm.
For the moment at least, there wouldn't be any strong response.
Mm-hmm.
There was nothing to worry about.
So now the Bolsheviks actually do have to govern in conjunction with the Soviets, and we get a movement in your book from the closing of the Sichuan Assembly to the institution of Red Terror. Maybe you could take us down that road.
Well, let me explain the connection between the Bolsheviks coming to power and the Bolsheviks in power, and why I was driven to spend another 30 years on another 12 months.
I understand that completely, but maybe some of our listeners won't, but go ahead.
Right. Well, I mean, here was a revolution that was staged in the name of free Soviets, a multi-party system, constituent assembly, a land of the peasantry, immediate peace, all those things, by free Soviets, and a relatively free party, and Bolshevik party. And the standard interpretation is that having seized power, Lenin, well, first of all, there was no free party according to standard interpretation. Soviets weren't free at all either.
Mm-hmm.
But I know different from my research.
Mm-hmm.
But the one criticism from people like Pipes, conservative historians, that I found compelling was then if what you say is true, if the party was relatively free and democratic, if Soviets were relatively free and democratic, how were they so quickly transformed into an authoritarian party controlling an authoritarian government? And so that was a question that bugged me, bothered me, and I had to try to answer.
Mm-hmm.
I spent the 80s with materials trying to answer that question.
Mm-hmm.
Materials available in the United States and available to me in Russia. I was dissatisfied with the answers because very soon the Bolsheviks had closed down opposition newspapers, which were an important source of information for me. And, to make a long story short, a lot of the kinds of data that I was able to collect on 1917 weren't available for 1918. But, but the point I want to make is the purpose is to better understand the transformation that occurred after the October Revolution into the horror that the Soviet Union ultimately developed into, but without access to the kinds of sources I had for 1917, it was very, very difficult.
Mm-hmm.
I remember giving senior fellow at Columbia for a couple of years. And I remember towards the end trying to put everything together, and it just didn't hold together.
Mm-hmm.
And so here I was, already spent 10, 15 years on this book, and I just wasn't at all happy with it.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't have that feeling of, boy, I'm going to show them that I had with the July Days and the October Revolution. In 1990, during the Gorbachev era, first probably Bob Tucker, then Steve Cohen, the Bukharin biographer, got into the archives, I was on the exchange, and I asked for archives, and lo and behold, I was given some. And then all through the 90s, I kept getting more and more material, and that answered many of the questions that I wanted to answer about the dynamics of the change.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll tell you the ultimate result, which you know because you've read the book, but maybe our listeners don't, The answer, it does not lie in Leninist ideology or some plan that was hatched after the Bolsheviks seized power, but on the circumstances that confronted the Bolsheviks mm-hmm. after they took power.
Mm-hmm. And those were?
They are forced to rule. They are not very comfortable ruling. They're born rebels. They first try to use the old institutions of government and then the old people, and that doesn't work. Meanwhile, opposition to them grows. The party is denuded by having to furnish people for the armed forces, for mm-hmm. for work in Soviets, for police work, et cetera, et cetera. So the party becomes smaller and smaller and smaller. The party membership becomes smaller and smaller. The Soviets become smaller and smaller, and less democratic. Who has time for, you know, finding out what the masses want, and playing by the rules when you've got all these problems, and then the fear of German invasion.
Mm-hmm.
What do you do? You've only got a fraction of people left, and not the smartest either, in the party, because the smartest ones go into the Soviets, and you develop this siege mentality, which is what happened,
mm-hmm.
and you lose these the ideals became lost relatively quickly. What mm-hmm. I try to do in the book is. Show how these ideals, how these sort of democratic structures, Soviets and the party, begin to be transformed. Because the process, I'll tell you later a little bit about what I'm working on now, but this book raises questions too. Inevitably, willy-nilly, often against the better judgment of the people involved, the institutions are transformed into undemocratic institutions. The district Soviets, which are key to Soviet Party at the local level, very democratic in 1917, become sort of fiefdoms. That's what I trace step by step. First of all, how the at the very beginning, how the Bolsheviks don't have the slightest idea of a party controlled Soviet government. Not the slightest. I got no instructions from above. And I trace it through November and December and January with the Constituent Assembly, and then through the struggle over of the Treaty of Brest-Litovsk and getting out of the war,
mm-hmm.
and the great conflict that raises within the party and. Among supporters of the party and among the Russian population, and then the terrible, terrible industrial crises of mm-hmm. the period, the hunger, leading to a situation where there are so few people. We're talking about in a city of it went probably dwindled to. To way less than the 2.5 million it was, but still, to a large city, to a party of a few thousand. Now, when it becomes a party of a few thousand, then what comes to mind? Well, we'll hold power by terror
mm-hmm.
and wait for the all the time waiting for the world revolution.
Yeah,
and
I think it's important.
Ends,
yeah.
The book ends with the celebration of the first anniversary of the revolution,
mm-hmm.
Which I used to show where these institutions, where the ideals are at that point.
Mm-hmm.
And it really was a huge celebration, still remembered, because at that time, it looked like some of the white armies operating in the Civil War had been defeated.
Mm-hmm.
But most of all, there were significant revolutions in Western Europe.
Mm-hmm.
The Kaiser had abdicated,
mm-hmm.
And it really looked like things were finally going to turn out the way they had supposed what
mm-hmm.
they were supposed to be.
Mm-hmm.
I had originally contemplating calling the book "Price of Survival,"
mm-hmm.
And that title, which my wife, who is editor director of IU Press, and would have none of that.
You know, editors decide everything in the end.
Yeah. Anyway, she. He said, "Price of Survival" doesn't tell you what the book's about.
Right.
And, could be love story, right?
Yeah.
It could be anything. And so she had me get rid of that. So that's the title of the last chapter.
See.
But I see this loss of ideals, this loss of democratic structures, as the price of survival. This hope of survival until the world revolution.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I see. I think it's important to put that in context because they really were waiting for something to happen abroad. The Russian Revolution wasn't just about Russia in the minds of the Bolsheviks. It was also about revolution spreading to Western Europe, where they thought it should properly proceed.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and I don't think they were prepared at all for actually ruling Russia outside a context in which there would be international revolution. So when they had to actually do the business of government, they found themselves at kind of a loss.
They really did try, and I show places where examples of that. They really did try to maintain some of the structures and the ideals, and they were idealists until the very end.
Mm-hmm.
But they just couldn't do it. And I end the book with. In kind of a gory way, we get the celebration, but it's prefaced by the Red Terror in Petrograd.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
My dad left Russia on the middle of August,
mm-hmm.
left Petrograd,
mm-hmm.
Thankfully, because he would have been among them shot.
Yeah.
The Red Terror in Petrograd was much worse than in Moscow. Much worse than anywhere else, and
mm-hmm.
I try to explain why.
Mm-hmm.
And I try to describe the terrible atmosphere, the terrible situation during the Red Terror
mm-hmm.
in Petrograd, mm-hmm. and then and end with the celebration when the terror has sort of ended, and everybody thinks, well, that was the price we had to pay, and that's
mm-hmm.
why I had called it originally the price of survival.
Well, maybe the next edition.
Well, it's funny you say that. I don't know. Should we?
Yeah, I was going to say, you know, thanks very much for spending all this time with us. We really appreciate it today. And we have a kind of traditional final question here on the show, as some of the listeners will know, and that is, Alex, what are you working on now?
Well, I got a Mellon Emeritus Fellowship.
Oh, fantastic.
To do with colleagues in Russia the first and only edition of the protocols of the Petersburg Committee,
uh-huh.
Bolshevik Committee in 1918.
Uh-huh.
It was supposed to come out in 1928, was stopped by Stalin.
Yeah.
And we're working on that, and so I'm going to Petersburg fairly frequently. At the same time, I'm working on a book which I tentatively called the Petrograd Bolsheviks during the crises of 1919.
Mm-hmm.
There were huge military crises then, and
mm-hmm.
it looked like the whites, Yudenich, would take
mm-hmm.
Petrograd and stifle the revolution. It didn't succeed,
mm-hmm.
But it was during those that crisis that some of the things that I was looking for to happen in 1918 finally happened, where the party began to control the Soviets, and the two almost merged.
Yeah, I see. Well, you have to promise to come on the show when you're done with that book.
Well, I would be honored.
I hope you do. Well, anyway, I should tell our listeners we've been talking to Alex Rabinowitz about his new book, The Bolsheviks in Power, The First Year of Soviet Rule in Petrograd. Alex, thanks very much for talking with us today. We really appreciate it.
You're welcome. I enjoyed it.
Absolutely. Bye-bye.
Bye.
You've been listening to an interview with Alex Rabinowitz about his new book, The Bolsheviks in Power, The First Year of Soviet Rule in Petrograd. It's just recently been released by Indiana University Press. My name is Marshall Poe, and I'm the host of New Books in History. I hope that you have a good week, and talk to you next week.